Welcome to VarmBlog, where our aim is to give you the best in analysis in philosophy, political economy, history, art, culture, and geopolitics from a left-wing and socialist-friendly perspective. We aim to bring you different perspectives from different walks of life and to have you educate yourself what to do with what you learned here. We do not aim to give you prefabricated and easy answers. Abandon all hope, ye who subscribe here, for you will learn, and it will be your responsibility what you do. And with that, let's begin today's episode. Hello and welcome to VarmBlog. Today I am with Joy of Zoonosis with Joy and Member School fame. Joy is a DVM with interest in society, animals, and health and the intersection thereof. And today we are talking about animals, persons, and the development of humanity. And I use persons deliberately ambiguously here. I do not necessarily just mean Homo sapiens. And we're going to get into why through the course of this discussion. And, you know, there are a couple of animals that I find very fascinating in their development with us weird monkeys. Well, apes, we don't have tails, so we're not technically monkeys. But, before my weird Linnaean fans get me in the show, in the comments. And that is, you know, dogs, cats, interesting, domestic food animals, including ones that I don't think we should eat, like pigs, and because they're too smart. Although really that's my bias against eating smart things is probably ableism, but and horses. So, and I think horses are an interesting way into this discussion about, you know, human society, human evolution. I'm gonna put that in quotation marks, and whatnot, because a whole lot of human development happens around horses. And right after you did a class on this very topic for member school, I remember there was a joke in the Barbie movie that I thought was unintentionally hilarious about, you know, patriarchy not being about horses. And I was like, oh, but Ken, it really is about horses. we'll kind of start with horses. We won't stay there. But why is understanding humans' relationship to the horse so illuminating to what people are?
I think that's a great question. Horses are really an important kind of pivotal animal in the human-animal bond. And with horses, they are an animal that is a production of power, but they can also be used for a lot of different things, and they give a lot of options. And it's the optionality of the horse that allows it to have so many roles and adopt so many different pathways in societies. So speaking vaguely there, but more specifically, if you think about horses, what do they do? Horses are large animals, so they can be, you know, they're able to convert low energy plant matter, grass, into muscle. And that conversion is done through hindgut fermentation. With that fermentation, it allows them to build quite a bit of bulk. And a lot of societies have eaten horses as meat. They have used horses for their milk. A lot of the societies drank horse milk quite frequently. They use the horse's hide, that kind of thing. Those are kind of our, you know, when we think about primary products, the things that you have to kill an animal for. The secondary products for the horse really make it one of the most versatile animals and one of the keystone animals for understanding power and power dynamics, basically. The horse, I mean, people have been riding horses probably for at least 5,000 years, if not longer. And the horse allows an unparalleled degree of mobility. So with the horse,
what you can do is you can actually attack a group of people or launch attacks and then get away quickly. In fact, getting away quickly, that's the challenge, right? So, you know, if you're on foot, you're only as fast as you can run, basically loaded up with gear and whatever stuff, booty you stole, basically. But with the horse, you can get in, get out, and strike quickly and take what you want and leave, basically. And it's that mobility that allows people to project power over distance and cover distance probably fastest that was possible before the invention of the steam locomotive. With that horsepower, people built enormous empires. They spanned continents. They were able to deliver messages and keep empires running. We think about the, you know, Imperial China, for instance, had quite a large mail system where they had posted offices all along the roads of the empire, and horses would travel along these roads with, messages and goods. And it allowed for the functioning of that empire. The other aspect with horses and power dynamics is, of course, slavery. Horses are one of the main animals that enable human slavery and enable the continuance of that, basically. Horses are, people mounted on horses have been used to capture and monitor slaves for thousands of years. We have evidence of that dating back to the Assyrians. We have evidence of that with the Yamnaya and the Indo-Europeans. One of the major slave trade routes in Sahara was a horse slave trade. So people from West Africa were traded for horses from the Maghreb. And there was a bilateral flow that went between West Africa and the Maghreb for about 400 years or so. And horses, of course, were also used in New World slavery. A lot of the horses that were used in Jamaica and Guyana came from places like Rhode Island, where we get a lot of those ambling horse breeds. So that, use of horsepower for maintaining human slavery is also another way we think about it. And moving into the industrial era and into even modern times, horses have been used for their power for traction. We think of, tractors today as being the major way that we plow our fields. But until very recently, horses were the main animal for doing so. And the use of horses to maintain this allowed for the building up of European horsemanship, basically. They had all these plowed fields that were needed horses and needed strong-legged horses for doing that. And a process of selective breeding over hundreds and hundreds of years developed larger and larger breeds of horses for that very specific function. Now, it wasn't only until very recently that horses, lost their military and agricultural and industrial roles. They still maintain quite a lot of power symbolically. Horses cost millions of dollars at some of the high-end competitions. And horses and horse trading is still a focal point for a lot of human relations today, and it holds tremendous symbolic value. And that symbolic value is nothing to shake a stick at either. I mean, we think about someone standing on horseback and, the statues that have been taken down in the American South and other parts of America with the white man on the horse being used as a symbol of racial terror. So horses have a very important role of projecting power and for maintaining a lot of these relationships in the imperial core.
The horse is tied to... human slave raiding is something that has both subconsciously crossed my mind, but until I started engaging with your work over at Member School, it never consciously crossed my mind. I'm simply, okay, there's something different there about the relationship with the horse, the ability to raid and capture and separate peoples from other peoples who would retaliate and or protect them very quickly. I mean, that's the key thing here. If you capture an entire community and there's a nearby related kinship bond community nearby, they're going to counter raid if you're on foot because you are effectively equal in distance. But a horse, more than most other human transport pack animals, increases the speed of movement to the point where you can put enough distance between you and another group that could go and liberate those slaves. While, you know, you have human slavery before that, the conditions of it being widespread enough to be in an industry and not a kind of byproduct of tribal warfare is sort of unique to horse period invaders. And that makes stuff like, yeah, early Indo-Europeans and their horse cult all of a sudden starts to make sense, right? It's, mm-hmm. But you know, it's also interesting what you mention about, horses and domestication in general, because one thing that has occurred to me is like horse milk was probably at least contiguous with development of human use of bovine or other milk, maybe probably before it, because if you look at where the development of the human ability to like process lactose comes from, it does seem to come from horse areas more than say cow areas. And for those of you who don't know what I mean, if it, like, you know, cows are all over the place, but lactose intolerance is pretty common in North Africa, where there's still a bunch of cows. Whereas, like, it does seem like Indo-Europeans and other Asian steppe peoples develop the ability to process milk fairly early. And by that, I don't just mean been like literally biologically they develop the ability to process milk fairly early. Although it is interesting to think about horses as food, not because it doesn't make sense they can bulk up and they're fairly lean meat, but it is interesting today that there are two animals that when I talk about eating, people freak out about, and I kind of get it, because we're usually most people who are in societies where these animals are common or heavily bonded to them, but it's dogs and horses. Mm-hmm. I've had friends of mine freak out about horse meat, and I'm just like, but horses are, I mean, they're not that different from cows. Like, just putting it out there. Mm-hmm. And dogs aren't that different from pigs. So do you think that has to do with power associations or long histories of domestication? Why has there been, it's not the people, there's plenty of cultures still eat horse meat, but it does seem to be in Western culture kind of frowned upon in ways that aren't entirely just rational.
I think that's a good question. You touched on a number of things there with the milk and with its association with the Indo-Europeans, and also with the taboos surrounding eating certain animals. The horse meat taboo is a relatively recent one, and not one that's universally shared. You think about horse meat being a dirty meat. I think a lot of that is associated with it goes back to ancient Rome, right? Horse meat was slaughtered differently, and it was done by different people, basically. Butchers would butcher cattle and pigs and other animals that were considered meat animals. And in ancient Rome, the meat napper was the person who usually did it. And it was usually considered one of the lowest kind of rungs on the socioeconomic ladder. You know, the person who napped the meat was basically just processing carcasses on the side of the road so that he could make a quick buck with, you know, the old stringy horses. And that association with low class and that sort of thing also gets tied in with race. There's an emerging literature on the subject that suggests that eating horse meat is associated with chattel slavery in the New World. If you think about it, horses were used for these slave plantations, so sugar plantations and for the cotton plantations. They were often worked death. One of the papers I was reading put the average lifespan of a horse on one of these plantations as something like 3 years or so. The mortality rates were absolutely high. Part of the reason is that these horses were just simply worked to death. And when they dropped and when they died, their meat became food for the slaves working on these plantations. And so it obtained quite a negative bias and associated with race that way. That association stuck around in the Anglo world. I mean, it's still present up to this day. And of course, Part of what reinforces that is because of the special relationship people have with horses, very individual, personalized relationship. And that human horse bond is, you know, it's a very personal bond. We consider animals as our kin, as members of our family. Horses, especially horses and humans, have this very elaborate reciprocal bond. Not so with other food animals. The food animals, we usually think of them as things that are standing out in the field, you know, like corn or wheat, that kind of thing. But with horses, they're like members of our family. They are, you know, our dogs and our cats. They are companion animals. In France, the association with horse meat was overturned. The negative associations, I should say, five social reformers in the 19th century. They were very adamant that getting people to eat horse meat was one of the cures for, you know, to make people look, you know, stop looking down on the poor and that sort of thing. And to this day, I mean, some of the biggest consumers of horse meat in the world are, you know, in France and Switzerland and in Italy. But not in the United States, which is one of the major exporters of horses intended for slaughter. America actually has a de facto ban on horse meat slaughter. So one of the things is that it's illegal to actually inspect meat for horses, basically. So there's no funding, federal funding for observing the slaughter plants that process horses in the United States. So what do? They export them all, you know, all the unwanted horses, horses that are surplus foals, that kind of thing, from a lot of farms. And they actually get exported to Mexico and to Canada. Canada has one of the largest industries of, you know, horse meat feedlots. And the horses are just fed, you know, meat and other slaughtered. Some of them are actually flown live across overseas to places like Japan, that sort of thing. And they're eaten that, you know, over there as well. So, I mean, it's by no means a universal. And I think a lot of it has this historical contingency to it. With horse milk, too, kind of coming back to that, horse milk is very interesting because it seems to be secondary to people who are already quite familiar with the milking of other animals. And horse milk has very unique properties compared to other kinds of milk. It's very high in lactose and low in curd, you know, the curd, the milk fat, milk that sort of thing. So it's really good at fermenting, and fermented horse milk is a delicacy throughout much of Central Asia. And that's one of the best ways to preserve it that way. And to this day, I mean, it's pretty much the only place in the world you can get fermented horse milk. It's not exactly a product you could buy over the shelf, you know, on the shelf around here. People would be horrified by something like that. It's very strange because, you know, the ancestors of the Indo-Europeans probably drank milk from the horses from time to time. It probably wasn't a huge part of their diet, but, over a billion people speak in an Indo-European language, and very few of them, you know, consider a horse a food animal. I mean, what happened there? So there's definitely a lot going on there in terms of, you know, what animals we consider food and why. I mean, we think about food animal taboos, and a lot of different cultures have them, right? Of course, we know the same prohibition against eating pork in Judaism and Islam, the prohibitions against eating beef in the sub-Indian subcontinent. Horses have a, I think it's a very different, you know, it's a similar but different thing with horses, because they seem to have that, you know, emphasis on class. And there's also the historical contingency of, you know, the Anglosphere perpetuating a lot of those historical biases up to the present day.
Well, yeah, I think about, for example, some of the pernicious effects of that in regards to pork versus dog. Dog meat and the Republic of Korea, South Korea, is effectively like horse meat here. It's not, there's no regulations for its slaughter. Now, there, that doesn't mean they export it. What it means is that there's a gray market in dog meat. You can buy it and eat it. That's totally legal. And actually, it leads to the slaughter being probably crueler than it would be if it was regulated and sold on the market. And so it's a kind of irony that in trying to placate a Western cultural bias about dog meat, the conditions for dogs raised for meat is actually probably worse than it would otherwise be. But, you know, as a person who didn't used to have any problem eating almost any meat barring human, and now I don't eat meat hardly, like, at all. I have found some of the cultural narratives about meat quite interesting, and also the extent in which it goes. I mean, one of the interesting things about the Indian subcontinent ban around cows is cows are still really important agricultural animals for South India. It's just they don't eat them. But milk, even dung, not as food, but as a fuel source, is actually super important for, you know, 19th century Indian economy. So much so that some people have even speculated that, like, part of that taboo is practical. I'm always a little skeptical on taboos being ultimately practical. You just like with pork and trichinosis, but I'm like, there's other stuff that is totally kosher to eat that are bad, that can totally make you sick, guys. Like, it's not just pork. But I also was thinking about your thing about, you mentioned human cultivation of, like, animals that we see as persons and animals that we don't. And then other societies where that's a little thinner. You know, the example for us would be obviously horses and dogs, and cats too, to some degree. We consider them companion animals and or work only animals. We do not consider them food animals. Whereas a pig, and pigs can be gross or not gross depending on the conditions which you keep them in. So that this is, if you spent time with trained pigs, you realize they're smarter than dogs. Are most dogs. And that we have to actively cultivate kind of an ignorance of their intelligence level and their sociability. And also when people like, oh, well, you know, humans don't eat a lot of predatory animals. And I'm like, have you dealt with boar? Do you know what they're like? They'll eat you. So that's an active cultivation in Western core European, post-European culture. But then I think about, so you think, okay, well, that's what it takes. But then I think about societies I know about, in, like, the Amazon River Basin, that see food animals as persons. And they will, like, for example, they'll eat small monkeys, but they will also cultivate those monkeys up to and including nursing them. Mm-hmm. And the relationship there is not that you are that you dehumanize or depersonify the animal to eat it. It's just an understanding that, like, these are members of our communities, but they're members of communities that we also eventually eat. Which I think I would like to know, like, you know, as a person who studies human relationship to animals, how common is that kind of relationship to animals? It when I've been reading recently on, like, indigenous concepts of relationality to not just people, but also animals, it comes up that certain hunter-gatherer bands in the Americas treat their prey animals as persons with whom they have a fairly reciprocal relationship. And some of the metaphors about hunting are sexual in a positive way, not in a rapey way. And that is a completely foreign way of thinking for, like, the average post-European core bro today, or really anybody. Like, how common are those relationships in your studies of human-animal development?
I think it's fairly common. I think that, you know, when we look at, you know, if you look at, interculturally, the way that Europeans, the weird way of thinking is the weird way of thinking when it comes to animals and relatedness, right? And I think there's definitely a trajectory there that can be explained partly by the way that Europeans view the mind and view animal minds in particular. And it kind of goes back to, you know, this Cartesian idea, right? This idea, you know, Descartes in Discourses on the Method is looking at, talking about how blood is circulating in the body. And he says, well, okay, blood circulates in the body because the heart pumps it around and it goes in and out like the tides. Kind of mystified by the whole process. He doesn't really understand it. But it kind of freaks him out to a point where he says, well, wait a minute. This is all just like clock and gear work, basically. Where's the soul? You know, and this whole thing, you know, you look at the way that animals move, he says, well, they probably, you know, they don't have a soul. Like, so they don't really think. They don't have a thinking mind, basically. And there's, of course, a large reaction to this in a lot of the European intellectual thought comes to, well, maybe animals do have a thinking mind. Maybe they do have a soul. This is what Thomas Huxley asks when he's looking at a dead frog and zapping it with electricity. And he says, well, wait a minute, does a frog have a soul? And by the end of the 19th century, you get to people like Ernst Haeckel. His whole idea was that, yeah, no, animals do have souls. Souls are the mind and the, you know, the processes of the cells, and they're mortal. They're born, they live, they die, they have a life cycle. And, you know, consciousness is a form, it's, you know, a process of the soul, basically. And so this idea of the soul and the animal, I think, is part of the reason why people are so uncomfortable in the Western world with the eating of animals, because we view the mind as a, you know, sacred thing. And the way that thinking is done by animals is functionally no different than how we do it. You know, the discoveries that Darwin made and subsequent scientists confirmed that, you know, animals, by and large, I mean, they're all related to humanity. They all share a distinct kinship with us. And that idea of distinct kinship and the fact that all of our neurology is homologous, all of these different things, the brain, the sensory organs, they all share a common homology with the other animals, basically. So the way that animals think and feel, the ability to sensate discomfort and displeasure is very similar to ours. And that raises some very uncomfortable questions and thoughts, right? You know, the idea of can they feel pain? And, you know, the universal answer is, yeah, they can totally feel pain. And then this becomes, you know, where things like, you know, Peter Singer and all those, they spin out from there, basically. But other people's very different ways of thinking about this problem, right? You mentioned South America, you know, and the Amazon, right? Like the there's this book, what is it, Consuming Grief. They talk about the Wari and the funerary cannibalism. They eat the bodies of their ancestors, the people who pass away. And their idea is that the soul goes to the afterlife and becomes the pigs that they eat, you know, from day in and day out. And the act of the funerary cannibalism is kind of a symbolic representation that they're entering the food system again. They're entering the food chain, and their bodies have returned to the earth, basically, and returned to the people, and they're feeding them that way. The idea that people, you know, when the idea that we're uncomfortable with animals, we have to keep a distance and a veil of ignorance so that we can protect ourselves from the very horrific reality of, you know, the fact that these are thinking and feeling beings that we're eating and killing and breeding in large numbers for various purposes, you know, laboratory stuff and studies, that sort of thing, is very uncomfortable. The way that you deal with that is you basically say, yeah, they're my family, and yeah, I do feed on them because that's how we survive. This is the give and trade, the trade-off, basically. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but that's just the way it is for a lot of people, right? Like the way that people, you know, their horses, there's a very, you know, there's a deep kinship there, and there is that kind of, you know, pragmatic relationship. You know, the horse will serve us. Then when its time has come, you know, the horse will then be dinner, basically. You know, it's, eventually there's going to have to be some, you know, coming back from that, basically. So, yeah, no, I think there is quite a bit of divergence in the way that Western people think about meat and the way they think about animals. And I think it comes back to this this idea of mind and consciousness. And, you know, one thing I like to do is if I'm reading a book and they're talking about consciousness, you could just kind of, you know, control F, replace it with soul, and, you know, see how much is different there. See if it actually changes the meaning of what's being said in the text. I find that often people use the word consciousness in this very loosey-goosey sense when they're really just talking about souls, and they're talking about who has a soul and who doesn't. And animals, it's kind of an open question because, again, now that we know we're all related to the animals in the world, that's become a big theological problem for pretty much everyone living in the Western world.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I've recently gotten somewhat frustrated with some eco-socialists, believe it or not, because they kept repeating stuff from Marx on humans being unique because of our division of labor, that we're the only animals to do that, which is, if you don't have a clear, like, if you can't rely on, like, in soul consciousness anymore, Descartes, you have to come up with another way of maintaining the distinction, even if you're an eco-socialist. And I just kept saying when I was reading this, you're just accepting that because Marx and Engels say it, because there's no, anyone who's ever looked at primate studies knows that primates have division of labor. I don't know what you're on. You even see division of labor amongst, like, social birds. I mean, like, it's not... Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And social biology, I mean, like, the social biologists maybe take the wrong lesson from this, but yes, like you definitely see it in bees, ants, and any social insects. And it's just, it's sort of like, that's not what makes us human. And then, you know, when you start really getting into what's the distinction between a human and, like, say, most other great apes or prior hominid species, you get into some real messiness when you look at it other than anything other than that. Well, we're human because we are. Have a nice day. Bye. You know, we are a particular line of a genetic strain of apes. And, but even that, like the world shattering event when people realize, oh yeah, well, okay, human modern Homo sapiens could interbreed with Neanderthals, crap, and probably Davosians too. Like, it's you know, it's just like that whole concept starts to get muddled about what is a human, and then when you expand that to persons. And you think about the way humans have thought about personhood in the past. I mean, the Peter Singer move, and the Peter Singer move is weird because in some ways he accords, you know, more personhood to animals than he does disabled people. But depending on his mood that day, how edgelordy he wants to be. But the consciousness problem is interesting. It's interesting to me for a variety of issues. But with animals, it seems clear that once you get to the complicatedness of a fish, you have something like consciousness. And that is obvious to... You can't even say it's like, you know, civilized versus uncivilized people, because Dharmic religions also are like, well, of course, animals have consciousness and also... souls the way we do. They're just dumber. And they'll talk about how animals are dumber than us, but that's like, you know, which humans have found a way to self-flatter. But it's still basically assumed that, no, there's not anything essentially different about, you know, a cow from a person. And in fact, you know, there's this exercise in Buddhist and Hindu culture where you meditate on the fact that the cow has most likely been your mother at some point. Like, you know, so some people think, oh, this is only like primitive peoples. And I'm going to put that in quotation mark because I think that's a ridiculous concept anyway. I mean, almost all modern hunter-gatherers are anatomically modern humans in every way that matters. It seems to me that, like, it's literally just Europeans coming out of a Christian tradition that have this particular problem. We can expand it to the other Abrahamic religions. Although I will say that, like, animals and the accordance and relationality to animals is actually a huge deal in Judaism and Islam that is underplayed for whatever reason in Christianity. And it's specifically Western Christianity where it's the most underplayed, because you read, like, Eastern church fathers, they also talk about relations to animals as being important. And some of them even ventured that animals have souls like people, although it's theologically sketchy area for them to go into. And I find that very interesting to think about when you think about, okay, well, why, how could we have this factory farming system? One of the things I always talk about when I think about meat is, while I do have a certain Buddhist bias against killing things that we're not killing in self-defense, I also do think like, well, I also know that, for example, if I know what I'm doing as a hunter, that animal is going to usually have a cleaner death than if I'm just running through a bolt gun in a factory. And not always. And when it's botched, it's horrible. But, you know, I've hardly met that many hunters who enjoy a botched kill. Like, no one really likes it. Well, I'm not saying no one. There are sadists in the world. But most people really don't like it. So I think about that and I'm like, oh, well, you know, I think you're right that this creates a theological problem. That's a very real, like, and it's a theological problem that's been secularized, but it's still there. It also points out to the change in our particular scale of relations to animals, because it's every now and then you'll meet, you know, I like to call them Wendell Berry types, who like talk about like the old way of handling animals and animal husbandry and giving the animals a good death. And even from the, you know, from the Western perspective, they kind of have a point that like you could monitor this better and do a better job. And you had a relation to the animal that you were slaughtering in a way that modern Americans and Europeans just tend to not have. They have no idea of, you know, animal slaughtering processes or field dressing an animal or having to get up into the guts of an animal or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they even, you know, I've even had people who eat meat freak out when I talked about, like, when I used to carry a golf club in my car because I lived in the whitetail deer capital of the planet, and people were hitting them all the time and leaving them, leaving on the side of the road. I'm like, yeah, we would go out and we would take, you know, a big blunt out of Jim Phil and killing them out of mercy. And people were horrified by that. And I'm like, but do you just want them to like struggle and bleed out for hours on the side? That seems pretty horrible. I wouldn't want to go that way. And that relationship seems interesting to me. But the reason why I brought it up in terms of the eco-socialists is I do think it has effects on how you think about solutions to ecological problems. Like, how mm-hmm. much are you considering animal life and for what reason? And, you know, what do you think is going on? You know, how you think that should be addressed when we handle things like climate change really will change your answers to certain problems. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit, like, in what ways do you feel like even animal rights discourse takes away, doesn't deal with these animals as persons concepts or our relationality to animals?
I think that's a great question. I mean, and it's a very tricky one too, because when we think about this, I mean, you talked about a bit about, you know, the fact that a lot of people are very insulated from the realities of what it means to actually kill an animal. And having done so myself, it's not a pleasant thing. And I don't think anyone would say it was, except, you know, if they were extreme sadists. It's very hard thing to, you know, do, basically. And the act of, you know, industrialized farming is really something that has a lot of gravity to it. I mean, not just like, you know, ethically or spiritually or whatever, but the fact of how much, you know, carbon and nitrogen and phosphorus is going through these systems, is being produced to raise these animals from, you know, from the first time that they're first born to getting them to marketable size. It produces huge amounts of pollution. It concentrates life in very big areas that become these zoonotic factories where disease is getting created between the humans and between the animals. And it becomes these hotspots where things, you know, you can have these big pandemics emerge. And I mean, you know, we saw this recently, just as recently as 2019 and 2020 with the COVID-19 pandemic and the way that kind of, went literally viral. The idea that, you know, that we could do this more, you know, humanely, and, you know, we do it full scale. I think that there's, you know, maybe there's something to that. Maybe there should be. There's also been quite a bit of, I guess, greenwashing by a lot of the beef and dairy lobbies, who are some of the most powerful lobbies and special interests in the world. They control quite a lot of the politics and that sort of thing around climate change and around, you know, policies around agriculture. They will lobby aggressively for maintaining subsidies and for getting special protections and looser regulations. And that really changes the face of how things are done. It's a model that grew up out of the colonization of the American West, largely, and the Canadian West as well. The areas that were denuded of bison and were, settled and colonized by peoples arriving were taken from indigenous peoples were, you know, quickly turned into cattle pasture. They were enclosed with large amounts of barbed wire. And all of those fields were either tilled for producing feed for these animals or grazed for the animals before they finished. And this system of intense farming of cattle, you know, would produce these feedlots where they get to a marketable size, and then they would go to the slaughterhouse. I mean, the first original big slaughterhouse center in North America was Chicago. We had all these cattle and all these large animals being shipped towards Chicago, where they would be slaughtered in large numbers, to the point where some of the rivers in and streams in Chicago you could walk across with the amount of animal tallow and byproducts that were floating around in it. Refrigeration allowed that meat to be shipped off to the four corners of the American Empire and even overseas. The leather, of course, went to baking for factory machines. And for other consumer goods, that sort of thing, quite readily. So that concentration of, it basically, when you think about it, what it's doing is you're basically taking all of the sunshine that cultivates the, you know, the grass and the wheat and the soy that goes towards feeding these animals. You're concentrating that and you're taking it from the soil and from the sun, and you're using it to feed these animals, which are going to other places and are being, you know, they're all that carbon and all that nitrogen and all that phosphorus is going somewhere else, and it's being going downstream and it ends up in the ocean. So you get all this like fertilizer waste. It's a massive extraction, a massive move of macronutrients across the food web in ways that have never been seen before in nature. And it has escalated to the point where it's threatening the stability of life on planet Earth. I mean, along with the burning of fossil fuels, part of which is done to produce fertilizer for these food crops or for moving the tractors or for taking care of the animals themselves. So I think a lot of that concentration, a lot of that movement, it's quite alarming. And it does require that, degree of separation and insulation for this to go on. You know, people have to be ignorant because otherwise it wouldn't exist, really.
But this leads to, I talk about, for example, semi-relocalizing food production a lot. Not in like the aughts way of the Michael Pollan just like going and, you know, buying from your local farmer, because a lot of times that does end up being boutique and inefficient, and it's really it's making an ethical consumption a luxury good. I get it. I understand those critiques and they're accurate. But I do mean in the sense of like there's this obsession with using microclimates to like mass produce certain foods, both in terms of plant life and in terms of animal life, that I'm always like, well, look at the cost of this, even if it is superficially efficient in some ways, kind of. Almost always that efficiency comes in downstream effects that you don't see. And when you mentioned, the amount of waste that goes into these large scale animal farming, you can think about in the Midwest and the West, these huge cow production facilities in particular. But I've also lived near the great chicken slaughter plants of the world, which are disgusting. And as a person who's lived near chickens, chickens are not the most clean animals on the planet, but they're nothing. It's nothing like being near a Tyson plant. But my one of the there's other, you know, the obvious is, you know, the methane going at scale going in to do something that would never happen in a natural ecosystem. There would never be enough cows in one place to risk global warming from methane. But there's other things about it that people don't see. So one of the things I always talk about is like, look, all this, the way we're using nitrogen fertilizer, mostly to grow feed, not for people, but for animals. This is going into like feedlot corn, not even the human consumption sweet corn or anything like that, for meat production, which you're creating massive algae blooms, which, you know, certain kinds of squid and jellyfish do fine in, but other kinds of fish just get wiped out by these red algae blooms and off the coast. And I just don't even hear it talked about when you talk about like centralization of this. Is like, this is related to animal consumption. And another example that I think is disturbing, I lived in northern Mexico for several years, and I lived in a place in the desert called La Laguna. Now, that means the lagoon. People thought that this was ironic because it's a pretty deserty place and there's not a lot of water, and the water there is gross. But it's not. Originally, it was a very luxurious lagoon, even though it was in this connection of three deserts. It was a very healthy microbiome. But it has no water now. And people think, oh, it's people doing this. And yes, but not in the way you think. People are not drinking the water enough to consume the water away from the aquifers. The aquifers are going down to where they're kind of now poisoned with natural arsenic. And this is not from pollution. This is just because you drink the aquifers in a desert area too well. But where is that water gone? Not into humans, it's gone into beef. Almost exclusively into beef, actually. So both into water for the beef cows and into feed, to growing feed, some of which is still imported from the United States. But this is offset costs in these systems. So when people talk about centralizing food systems and how it's more efficient, I'm like, it's only because there's a whole lot of offset costs in terms of the way we're handling animal life that you aren't seeing, and you're not factoring into your claims of efficiency at all. And that is beyond climate change. That is not even assuming, you know, the CO2 problem, which of course is massive and the biggest thing we have to deal with. But even if that wasn't there, even if you had some sort of carbon capture technology or whatever, this is still a major problem, and it's just hidden from you. And it's also, to bring it up in terms of like what it means, this is where, you know, discussion of environmental justice has legitimacy, because most of the areas, both within the imperial core and just outside of it in periphery, where this happens, this is offsided on the poor communities. They're the ones that have to deal with it. Even if it's just the effects of, say, water usage, like when where I lived in Torreon, poor people had splotchy skin. Why do they have splotchy skin? Because they couldn't afford to import in water. All right, the water is not poisonous immediately to you, but it is so arsenic contaminated, again, because of the aquifer has been drunk down so low, that if you consume it on a regular basis, you're going to start having low levels of arsenic poison, which is not going to kill you, but it is going to cause you to have splotchy skin. It's going to cause other health complications. It's going to cause kidney stones. And this is outsourced to various poor communities. And it's invisible to most people here. And every now and then on the glory that is the interwebs, people will show half-assed consciousness about this because about something like bananas. But this is true across the board, and it doesn't have to be that way. I've talked about, like, yeah, we'd have to die back, like some amount of agricultural production needs to die back, but You could still probably sustain fairly large human populations off of traditional agricultural methods with some technological augmentation, but we're not doing that. And I think it's interesting that part of what hides that, to bring this back to the animal point, is the relation to animals. If you see, you know, these animal concentrations and how we've done this way, you start realizing that, you know, we have made this horrible for the animals. We've also kind of made it horrible for other parts of ourselves, because we're hiding large parts of this process to us, and we're hiding what it entails to maintain a food system like this. To critique that does not mean that we're going to pretend that we can all just go back and be hunter-gatherers. Like, I don't think anyone who's serious actually thinks that. But it is something we have to deal with. And, you know, I think this is interesting in a lot of ways. You mentioned zoonotic disease. You know, I've been playing with the idea recently, even though I do think there was some racist stuff in the way zoonotic disease was portrayed about the wet markets in China. And I do think there is a small possibility that you know, gain of function research played into development of COVID. I do not discount that as a possibility, but I don't think it's particularly likely. I do think, like most prior COVID and flus that have developed, they come from usually an animal that's relatively closely contagious to humans, like, I don't know, pigs. You know, how many, I mean, Spanish flu, even though we blame it on Spain, probably came from the Midwest in the United States initially. Mm-hmm. And was a pig-borne disease in its early instantiation. I play with the idea sometimes that the reason why a lot of people really want to believe in gain of function research leading to this is because that's easier to deal with than the idea that, like, our meat consumption habits are actually dangerous to us in a real way, because we are falling down in our relations to animals. And I don't mean this in a, like, facile PETA, we can all become vegans tomorrow way, because I don't think that, like, even though I choose not to eat meat, I don't think it would be very hard to ethically run a meat-free meat-free maybe, but like an animal product-free world would be very difficult to do without other cost to animals in the long run. I think I do think we had, like, vinyl shoes versus leather shoes. And its cost to animals is actually not an easy question at all. Mm-hmm. I bring this all, I guess, as a way of kind of tying this in to your points about the studying our relations to animals really does tell you a lot about how we live ourselves. And right now we do seem particularly disjointed about it. One of my big things I point out to vegan activists and stuff, and this is not a gotcha to them, I'm more or less kind of on their side, but it's just like, well, veganism's increased dramatically, but it's been increasing dramatically directly in correlation to an increase in meat consumption worldwide. Yeah. So I don't know, maybe more traditional ways of handling meat would lead to a sharper decline in meat consumption than trying to convince everyone to be a vegan. So good luck on that. I wanted to ask you, though, I want to talk a little bit about dogs, maybe to as another way of getting into our strange relationship to animals. You know, you have weighed in on one of the weirdly, perpetually super hot button topics that I would never expect to be a hot button topic, and that is the banning of, quote, dangerous dog breeds. You actually, you know, talk about this being, in general, a terrible policy. Can you go into that and maybe the politics of that a little bit? Because I think we have to think about this in a larger context.
It's an interesting topic. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of this. One of the more recent cases, and the UK's had a number of laws on the books for years about this, but is the XL Bully, which isn't a real breed. It's just kind of a thing that kind of people made up. But XL Bully ban, basically, in the UK after a number of, dog attacks, basically. Dog attacks do happen. People live with dogs. And very rarely do people train their dogs to the extent where they are, you know, completely bulletproof. And then there's no such thing as a bulletproof dog. Any dog can get scared and snap and bite and that sort of thing. But, you know, get a large dog that can definitely cause a lot of damage. With a lot of these breed-related bans, of course, getting into the actual nitty-gritty of do they work, the fact is that no, they don't really, because they don't reduce the frequency of dog attacks or the severity necessarily. When you target a specific breed, you're only eliminating one sort of conformation, which may not be an actual genetic subset of aggression or anything. From list of all the different possible dogs that can bite a person, basically. There's a lot of this pseudo-eugenic stuff going on when it comes to dogs and the way that people associate certain, you know, shapes of dog skulls with certain behaviors. They've actually done studies about fear aggression in pit bulls and other dog breeds, and dangerous banned dog breeds, compared to golden retrievers, which are famous for being friendly and affable. And they found that there was no, you know, significant difference between any of the breeds, basically. Golden retrievers are just as likely as any other type of dog breed to have fear-based aggression and to, you know, bite people out of fear. Golden retrievers are not small dogs. They're quite large dogs, and they can do quite a bit of damage, you know. So it's something that, you know, when a dog does bite, it can cause significant damage. A lot of this stuff, too, I mean, you look at the actual numbers of it, you know, the most common dog breeds are the ones that are most likely to cause injuries to people and the most likely to actually lead to fatal injuries. So there's a lot of it's just basically people live in close proximity to dogs, and dogs can do things out of fear that they wouldn't normally do. And people get injured, specifically children and specifically people who are disabled and elderly people as well. When we look into the history of these breed-related bans, it actually ties back to the increasing police presence in primarily Black communities in the United States. There's been some arguments put forward, and I think they're fairly convincing, that the increased, specific dog breed bans were very specific to kinds of dogs that people, you know, Black Americans would own. Pit bulls being one of them. Pit bulls are, you know, you live in a poor neighborhood where the police aren't going to come when you call them, you know, where there's a lot of crime. You get a big dog. You get a big dog to protect your house, basically. And so these dogs were, you know, trained to be attack dogs or guard dogs. And, you know, people get bitten and injured, that sort of thing. And this created kind of a moral panic about the, you know, the inner city and, you know, fear of crime and that sort of thing. There's been an argument, too, that banning of specific breeds is kind of a de facto housing ban, basically, as well, for, you know, racial segregated housing. Because as soon as those laws started getting lifted in the United States, you get these breed-related bans coming in. So the person across from you, you know, your that house goes, you know, across the street, that house goes up for sale. If they own a specific dog breed and the community rules that they can't own it, then they can't move into that house. So there's a way that the animal is being used to enforce racial segregation. So not necessarily canine racism, but it's racism being used through canines, basically. And when we look at dog attacks, the most severe dog attacks, the ones that cause the most likely to cause injury, are from trained dogs, like police use. Police dog attacks can be quite severe. There's not like any database of this sort of thing, because of course, most police departments work independently of each other. They don't exactly want to post statistics about the number of dog injuries that are caused by them. But a lot of the police dogs that they use are these German Shepherds that are trained to go specifically for the limbs to apprehend criminals, and they hold their mouth in place basically until the police arrest them. And it can cause quite severe injuries basically that way. Most dog bites that people get from their dog at home are going to be on their hands or on the fingers. Very rarely is a dog just going to unprovoked bite somebody, basically. I like to say that anything with a mouth capable of biting, and I treat that with respect, because, you know, even a dog that's wagging its tail, that may be showing signs that it's friendly, there's always an outside chance that, you know, you could do something that spooks them, or they could get scared and they could do something that they wouldn't normally do. I work with a number of dogs that are, you know, dangerous, or, you know, have a potential to kind of have these moments of fear aggression, basically. When we think of aggression, we, you know, commonly think of, you know, mean or evil or negative qualities, but aggression is really just fear. When a dog is growling and its ears are back and its hackles are raised and it tries to bite, it's doing something that out of fear, basically. And so there's this negative connotation with aggression and with bites, that necessarily that this means that the dog is bad and not properly trained, but maybe the dog's just afraid and, you know, it's got trauma or something like that. And there is quite a bit of evidence to suggest that dogs can get traumatic, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, or the canine equivalent of it, basically. It's one of the model organisms of the people for that sort of thing, because animals learn associations. And when they form negative associations, it can, you know, trigger these stress-related sort of things. So I think that the, you know, these breed-related bans, not only are they, of course, you know, bad policy in terms of do they actually prevent dog bites, but they're motivated by a lot of these underlying factors. And I think, you know, I did mention eugenics. The breeding of it actually is related to eugenics. The people, you know, who started dog breeds in the late 19th, early 20th centuries were eugenics, eugenicists. They were working with eugenic societies in America and in Europe and in Canada as well. They were informing these people. They were, you know, sitting on their councils, and they were discussing how do we breed better people using technology that we developed for breeding dogs and breeding dogs for an ideal conformation. The founders of the German Shepherd dog breed, they were all German nationalists. They were trying to make the Volkisch wolf-like dog, basically, that would be the epitome of German values. And of course, we know who was a big fan of the German Shepherds is the Nazis, right? And Adolf Hitler. So this this emphasis on dog breeding and breeding for specific conformations, and this idea that conformation equals you know, behavior, there's a lot of pseudoscience around it, and there's a long and ugly history there's a long history of racism baked in there, I think, as well.
Yeah. I mean, yes. This has come out to the general public, but I remember, like, over 15 years ago realizing that all that alpha male talk and gender relations was based on, like, fundamentally misunderstanding wolves based off of studies done on wolves in captivity. And I was like, well, and this is going to sound terrible, but as a person who used to work in a prison, I don't think people are that different in prisons, and I would never, ever link prison behavior to the way people act, even in lumpen-eye circles, when they are free, because that's not what people do. They don't, like, that's a zero-sum situation that's artificially engineered and breaks down certain social bonds. I mean, if I was to go to prison, I would assume racial solidarity was impossible, because that is almost designed into prison maintenance to encourage racial clumping, which is beyond the scope. But one of the things that I learned, getting out of that world, and is really seeing that wasn't just something that develops under stress, although race as proxy for kinship bonds is something that happened under stress. That it was active, like, and kind of deliberately maintained in the middle of the 20th century. And while all that stuff has been theoretically removed, most of those prison designs and whatnot are very much actively still there. Do I think that people naturally sort that way? Absolutely not, actually. You know, I got plenty of evidence to the contrary. So I think it's interesting that we did that with dogs, and it reflects more about us and our, frankly, fucked up views of the world. Although I do think dog breeding is a very good counter response to human inventions and eugenics, because I'm always like, well, just want to talk about what we did to the most dog breeds by trying to hold them to a standard, because we shortened their life, we made them dumber, we I mean, yeah, some of the dog breeds have superpowers kind of for dogs, but also usually with way more cost to everything else than it's worth. And we all kind of want, I mean, you know, one of the ironies of like the Bully XL movement, you're right, it's not a real breed. A lot of these are like people realizing, hey, we really screwed up these dogs with these breeding programs. Let's like get a little bit looser and form our own slightly less eugenic kettle associations to save these animals and like not basically deliberately introduce genetic pathologies in them to the point of extinction. I've always found dog breeding to be one of those cases where I'm like, well, this is actually a good argument against eugenics, because I just want to show you what we've done to animals with this program, and it's not great. But it is interesting, and I think it's vital to note that we can't separate our ideas about animals from our ideas about people in a lot of ways. It is very important that like the kennel clubs of the world do come out of the same time when we are beginning to become obsessed with scientific racism, in a way that has no scientific validity. Although, terrifyingly, one of the things I recently discovered was I looked at the anthropology they teach forensic cops, and I was shocked that it was like mostly 19th century race science that almost even the most biologically reductionist anthropologists no longer think is valid. I remember looking at this chart of hair and like black, white, or admixture. And I was like,
oh my gosh,
they're still doing that? Because, you know, I also, just out of morbid curiosity, modeled my own hair. And I'm like, well, I'm an admixture, whatever the hell that means. So, you still see this stuff. And a lot of times we assume it's gone away. And sometimes, I mean, I hate to say it, sometimes it's just like, hey, a lot of these agencies are really cheap and they just haven't updated their material since like 1965. But some of it is, you know, a lot of these agencies have stuff that's been long since discredited and still maintained. And I also think it's a good point about police dogs, because German Shepherds, when I was a kid, if I was afraid of a breed, and I don't want to breed demonize, I've known plenty of lovely German Shepherds in my life. But if I was going to be afraid of a dog, it wasn't a pit bull. It was a German Shepherd. Or a shepherd dog in general, because they tend to, like, if you keep them as a pet and you don't give them proper socialization and exercise, they get anxious. And if that combined with fear, they're bitey. And German Shepherds, if you mistrain them, are trained bitey in a way that's dangerous to people. They're trained to be dangerous to people. You have to be very careful with them. And the shift to, oh my God, the pit bulls are going to eat your baby. Which I'm sure has happened once. I mean, I'm not going to say like it's never happened. I haven't seen it confirmed, but I'm sure that if I really looked, I could find a story. Animals do weird stuff. I mean, you know, every now and then a deer will eat meat. It'll really confuse you. That's another thing. That's another thing about what people assume, that animal behavior is like always static and they don't have any weird deviations or any choices. And I'm like, have you spent a lot of time with animals? They do weird stuff, and it's not all just instinctual. every now and then you'll see, like I said, you'll see a deer like eat a bird, and you're just like, that's not supposed to happen. Hippos that just decide to kill you because apparently in nature, every now and then a vegetarian animal is a real asshole. I do kind of laugh from like, you know, the animals that kill humans the most tend to actually not be predators. Hippos, a lot of people die by cow. Cause cow's a big ass animal that can both gore and or kick you to death. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of me is like, you can't blame them. We eat enough of them. But, like, it's kind of fair. So it is interesting to think about that. When we think about what we can learn about human politics, it really is important to study animal relations in this regard. And I also think it tells us a lot about what people are, you know, in our symbiotic relationship with animals. This is like and now I'm going to switch to my argument against PETA, because there I was like, well, humans shouldn't exploit animals. And I'm just like, I don't know what a human animal, even if we were all vegetarians, would do if we didn't live in concert in ways that you would recognize as exploiting animals, which is not a moral argument. I'm not making a naturalistic fallacy here, but it just seems to me like a weird demand, particularly when it gets to stuff like, for example, dairy. Dairy in the United States is a horrible industry, and I have to really reevaluate my morality every time I eat cheese, even though I love it. At the same time, there is a way which, like, it doesn't have to be a horrible industry. It does not actually have to be this way. We have chosen for it to be god awful in the way that it is. And we've done it basically for commodity production reasons. You don't have to treat, and most family cows were not treated this way in the past, but now we have evidence of like birthing trauma, because we're keeping, you know, milk cows constantly pregnant and then depriving them of their children, and that's horrible. But I don't know that every we would have to run cheese farms that way. Like, I always think about like goat dairy, or bring up the aforementioned horse dairy. Which I think is, you know, you're right that probably part of why that it's not super popular worldwide is it's not cheesable, and fermented, vaguely alcoholic milk is something that's a big sell to not just Westerners, but a whole lot of the world. Having said that, I've actually had fermented horse milk and it's pretty good.
Oh.
It's weird, but, you know, but it's weird because I'm a weird white guy from the United States who like has not experienced a lot of that sort of thing. I think it's something we have to think about when we talk about both how we're going to handle the climate crisis. It will involve a change of relationship with animals. I highly doubt you're going to actually convince the world to totally give up any use of animal products. And like I said, when I think about like vinyl shoes, I'm not even sure that it would be good to do so in all cases. Like, even, you know, maybe it's not wise in every single instantiation. But I do think one of the things I really think about is like, how can we inculcate people to think of not just the animals that are obvious, like, let's say great apes, horses and dogs, maybe a few other animals, elephants and dolphins, things that people know are smart and are mammalian and thus look like us. But think about relationships to animals in general, because human survival is largely predicated on the survival of most of these animal species. And when we talk about this in radical politics, I feel like this is often just left out, or it's given the PETA version of the world, just I don't think is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to that?
Yeah. So that's a really good point. Start off with like the PETA thing and the vegan movement and the vegetarian movement. I mean, think about like Peter Singer with his book Animal Liberation. Of course, the basis of it is this idea of utilitarianism, or this idea that we should minimize the amount of pain and suffering in the world, sure, and maximize the amount of pleasure and that sort of thing. The other move that he makes is that we should have equal consideration for every single living thing, basically. Every single animal that's capable of feeling pleasure and pain, and every single person that has, you know, pleasure and pain. And I mean, that's a noble idea, of course, but I don't necessarily feel that way about everyone in the world, let alone every single animal. You know, when you think about, you know, our morality is necessarily egocentric. Like we think about, you know, who's related to us versus, you know, someone who's distantly related to us. Who am I going to pull off the train tracks first? You know, my sister or my, you know, someone I've just met from, lived halfway across the world. You know, there's this idea that, you know, a lot of our morality is kinship centric or egocentric. And our relationships and our kinship with animals really tracks with that. When we see, you know, things that are really hard to anthropomorphize, even things that are, you know, intelligent animals or animals that have the ability to do remarkable things, that have very complex behaviors and that we just simply do not recognize. I mean, octopus is probably one of the, you know, kind of the most common example that's cited here, right? So cephalopods, they have this very large nervous system. They have very complex behaviors. They can learn. They can do all these, we could use tools, all these different things, right? But people don't treat them like they treat, you know, dogs, cats, you know, like they treat them like you would an oyster or a clam, you know, like they've got, you know, people eat them live. People, you know, will boil them. They will kill them, that sort of thing. People don't recognize the fact that, you know, animals have these abilities. If we did have the sort of kinship or connectionship with the outside world, with the animal world, maybe things would be a bit different. But of course, can't have equal kinship with everything because then it would be nothing, right? So we need to have this ability to recognize that, yes, the natural world is part of our own and we live in it. We can't ignore the reality of living in the world. Otherwise, we're going to run to a point where, you know, there's no more world left, where we don't have any sort of biological diversity. And the, you know, carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle are falling apart, and the world becomes unlivable. So there's got to be a point where we come to recognize the animals that are around us that have the mental abilities that, you know, but also have respect biodiversity and try to uphold biodiversity. Process of domestication and the bringing of animals into human relationships is a very selective one, right? It only selects for animals that are already at a point where they are, you know, amenable to that kind of interaction, that want that kind of interaction. If you had to pick the difference between a wolf and a dog, the real difference is that dogs want to be with people. They like this, you know, they have an ability to socialize with people where wolves don't. Wolves, you know, are afraid of people for a large part. They will actually avoid people. They will seek areas where there are very few people around, and they will, you know, hunt and be self-sufficient. Versus dogs, dogs will actively seek out people, and they will, you know, seek out human foods, and they will try to form human bonds with, you know, with us, basically. And this domestication, this drive is a filter. It's a biodiversity filter, basically. When we, you know, now that human civilization has gone to basically every single point on the planet, it's drawing all the animals in that can be domesticated, which is a very few number. I mean, only a few dozen animals have ever been domesticated successfully. And everything else is just kind of pushed to the sidelines in very, very increasingly small pockets of wilderness where we have, you know, wildlife parks and, you know, national parks, that kind of thing. These increasingly fragmented, landlocked little patches of wilderness areas, basically. And that leads to a huge loss of biodiversity. It also leads to a alienation with the world around us. And it leads, you know, it's causing a world where we're no longer able to, you know, capture the amount of, you know, capture carbon and cycle nitrogen properly. And that's leading to all sorts of different things. You know, also when we have all these, you know, we start breaking down the frontier and we go into the areas where these wild animals are, that exposes our domestic animals and us to these zoonotic diseases. And I brought it up before, but you think about, you know, we mentioned earlier with the influenza chickens, I think, are a great example because you get something like, you know, migratory birds. They interact with a domestic chicken. They could just simply pass through the bars of most commercial chicken farms. And it will spread through a chicken flock like wildfire. from chickens, it can usually, it sometimes will go to an intermediate species like pigs, where, you know, you get several strains and they'll recombinate and then form a new strain that becomes even more deadly and more infectious. And that's how you get these really virulent strains of influenza. And those are becoming more and more frequent, and becoming more and more severe each time we do it. There was a big scare because there was the, you know, massive die-offs of birds from influenza, and that had a real potential, and it probably still does, of launching us into another major influenza epidemic, if not pandemic. So I think that there is, obviously we have an egocentric anthropomorphic bias towards animals that are easy to relate to, that look human, that are intelligent, that we're able to form these domesticated relationships with, and it's to our detriment. Obviously, not everything can be as charismatic as a lion, or as intelligent as a chimpanzee. Can't even be necessarily living in a place as beautiful or scenic as the Amazon rainforest. A lot of the animals, most of the biodiversity on the planet is insects. And insects are, famous for being, people are disgusted by them. They are repulsed by the idea of these things that are crawling around and sharing the world with them and their homes with them. Most insects are completely harmless, if not beneficial, and become a huge problem because we've moved on to an agricultural system where we spray everything with pesticides. They recently came out with a paper that showed that pesticides and fungicides actually block the ability for bees to smell, which doesn't sound like a huge thing. It's like, well, maybe they can't find the flowers. But really, that means that bees can't have any social communication because everything they do is based on smell. All the pheromonal communication is done through smell. And so our ability to, the way that we interact with our agricultural systems with the insect world is completely upside down, bakazoo. We need to find different ways of relating to the natural world.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, one thing I always tell people, there are two things that I would assume the universe was, or if I was an alien coming to the planet, I would assume the dominant species on the planet were beetles and bacteria. Like, that's what I would assume. And then maybe crabs, because crabs keep on re-engineering themselves. If you want to talk about, like, apparently the platonic form of animal is a fucking crab. But, because they keep on showing back up, and they have completely different genetic strains. We're just somehow meant to be pincher thingies with hard shells. But, it is... I do think about it a lot because on one hand, when we talk about, the penis, they talk about this bias towards things that are like you as irrational. I don't think it is irrational to actually have a kinship bias. I don't. On the other hand, I'm with you that at this point with our level of development, that ain't going to be good enough because, it barely keeps us from eating things that are cute, like, pigs are domesticatable. They're cute and they're smart. You think we would feel a little bit bad about what we do to them. But there's a whole lot of species out there that, I really worry about amphibians. It's hard to feel cuddly about a frog. I've tried, it doesn't work.
Has a frog a soul?
A frogicelle is not something I think I'm going to easily become. I've also tried to keep lizards and feel the joy of lizardness, and I don't. They're basically, I have the same relationship to most lizards, even when I respect their intelligence, that Werner Herzog has to chickens. And yet, I realize that they're really important parts of the environment. Cephalopods, hell, if we continue doing what we're going to do in the ocean, they're going to be overlords anyway, since they don't think it's going to be able to survive it. So maybe we should think about that now. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I've been through, I have been at the seat in a place in East Asia where you're served a live octopus, and And I've also tried not to be a total ethnic chauvinist about it, but it's also like, well, I don't know. I don't feel good about eating something that is actively still fighting me. Feels a little weird. So I do think we really have to rethink about this. And I think it's something that as we go forward in politics, I do think maybe thinking about this as relations with things that we need to have around, even though they're ugly, like you're right, beetles. I mean, you know, people freak out about large cockroaches, for example, and I try not to because I realize that, like, yes, German cockroaches are bad news for people, but most cockroaches aren't, and they're not going to go away. They're not going to usually infest anyway. There are things that we have to worry about, like, say, rats, but even those, I mean, a rat is actually a remarkably smart animal. Like, so, you know, and they do seek people out because we're a good source of free food and shelter, actually. But beyond that, you know, the history of humanity's plagues is a history of zoonotic diseases. And so we do have to take that somewhat seriously. And we do have to think about what that means about our relationship to animals. And one of the things I think a lot about, and I know people are going to think this is weird, but like as we design cities into the future, how can we make cities more animal friendly? Because we need them. And we also need fairly high density, you know, maybe not as high as we have them in some places, but fairly high density housing. So how do you combine those two things together, like an awareness of the natural world and high density housing? And I think it's perfectly possible to do. We just aren't doing it. Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of things that these are the weirder parts of farm politics that I think a lot about, that it's related to changing the way we think about animals. And I guess to bring it back to something we said very early on about, you know, way we think of animals in relation to power, but also the way other cultures have thought about animals. Practicing thinking about animals the way other cultures do, even if you can't maintain it, often is very useful for breaking up your assumptions about what we're currently doing, or like even like how we're designing agriculture. Do we have to do even large scale farming this way? Like, you know, and stuff like that. Like, I don't want everyone to have to be a farmer. I don't think it'd be efficient, but like the current way we're doing farming to me is unviable. One of the ways to think about that is to change your way of thinking about our relationship with animals. And you'll start thinking about these other knock-on effects. And if you're going to have large scale farming, how do you deal with that? I do think it's a matter of orientation. And, weirdly, the places where you see it the most is in primate studies and people who work in animal medicine, because you guys deal with animals all the time and thus realize that a lot of us are fooling ourselves about how different they are from us. And cultural anthropologists, because they end up doing a whole lot of like, well, why do other people think about animals in this fundamentally different way? And then you realize, you know, one of my big realizations is I was reading a Marshall Sarlin's book, and he just pointed out, you know, Westerners think that like it's a shock that we are like animals, and like that civilization is holding our animality back. And he's like, well, most cultures don't see that big of a difference between people and animals, but also it's not that you know, cultures holding the animal back. It's like culture is what makes us human, but also the assumption is that animals are persons just like we are not just like we are, but on a spectrum of relationality to us. And it does seem to me that that attitude may help us get past certain problems that we're currently having right now, that where we're just doing crazy things involving real animal life in ways that is detrimental to ourselves.
It's funny that you mentioned lizards. I actually have lizards. I'm a reptile keeper, I guess. I've got a ball python and a leopard gecko. I've had my leopard gecko for 15 years now, probably going on 16, I think, and my ball python for a number of years too. It's one of those things where, you know, like having, you know, we thinking about the way that we interact with animals, or the thinking the way that, you know, helps us to really understand how we, you know, interact with each other as well. I mean, understanding that surface appearances aren't everything, and that, you know, you have to kind of get through your initial, once you get over the initial biases, maybe you can get to a place where you can understand things a little bit better that way. I think you mentioned earlier too, half an hour or so ago, about the Neanderthals and the way that our understanding of relationships with them really changed the way we thought about Neanderthals quite a bit. I remember when the news came out that we had quite a bit of Neanderthal DNA came to fruition in the public consciousness. Public perception changed quite a lot. It used to be that, you know, Neanderthals are the sluggish, slow, stupid. They are the evolutionary losers. They didn't have culture. They didn't have anything. And then we found out, oh, wait a minute. Those are our ancestors, at least a little bit. And we said, well, oh, then maybe they weren't so bad. You know, like maybe there's something else going on there. You know, there's a little bit of, chauvinism there. I mean, you know, this understanding that, you know, maybe if we're related to them, maybe they're not so bad. And when it comes to that, I mean, yeah, we should have some different ways of thinking about things and relating to things that necessarily aren't related to those relationships.
With Neanderthals, I think that glow up is even doubly pernicious, because it's also the case that, like, oh, it's Europeans and Asians that are related to Neanderthals and not sub-Saharan Africans. So now they're superhuman and awesome. And like, I mean, you know, it's doubly pernicious. Devosians have not yet gotten the same glow up, even though they're probably a fairly significant part of our DNA. So it's, that is absolutely true. So I would say, like, there's a double grossness on that one, but you're absolutely right. We talk about ancient hominids, and we just tend to assume the ones that aren't in our direct line must have been just stupid. I mean, even when we talk about, there's a huge focus on chimpanzee and bonobo intelligence, and like, look, they are very intelligent animals. I don't know how much you can deduce about human behavior from them. You can deduce a lot and nothing simultaneously. Also, because as our two comparison species, bonobos and chimps act wildly differently. And they went wildly differently to us too. It is interesting to me how, like, why we focus on the great apes, because they're like us. I mean, they basically are us. There's the chimps who are super smart but mean. There's bonobos who are super smart but horny. And we kind of talk about gorillas, but they're vegetarians, so we don't know so much about them. And orangs are cool, but I guess they look weird. So, but they're all, you know, there's a natural obsession with them, because, you know, if you've ever dealt with an orang or a chimp or whatever, they are awfully close to human. Although my response to them is, be careful, because a chimp is awfully close to human, but it will also rip off your face and eat it. So yeah, fair. whereas gorillas are like, if you're not a threat to them, they probably won't. they can, and every now and then they'll remind you, but it is interesting to think about our relations to animals. And I think, if there's anything that I really enjoy about the work you've done over at Member School, and I am now going to be exploring your Zoonosis YouTube channel. You have an interesting video on the Danish mink calling and its relation to COVID, that I didn't even know about. So I'm going to be plumbing those depths. But it is interesting to think about how much that relation to animals tells us about human beings. And I do think if we're bracketing that out of our political discussions, we are leaving out a crucial thing about being human and about our relationship to animals, because I don't think we survive long in a world without biodiversity personally. I mean, I might be wrong about that, but I also don't want to find out. So, mm-hmm. And we're awfully close to yeah. being in that world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting. You brought up the difference of bonobos, right? Like, and the great apes. I mean, it wasn't until the 1950s and 60s when the Leakey started, digging up, Australopithecines in Africa that it confirmed Darwin's suspicion that humans came from Africa, that we came from these chimpanzees and bonobos are closer related to those. The alternative explanation was that we came from Southeast Asia or, some lost continent of Lemuria. That was, like Wallace and Haeckel were both into that because it evolved, it sidestepped the problem of, hey, maybe we're from Africa. This idea.
Yeah, I was going to say Engels picked up on Lemuria too because Hegel believed in it. But anyway, back to the that gets dropped in our discussions of that.
The thing that's very different from humans and the other great apes is our relationships with other animals, right? Like we don't see chimpanzees going around domesticating dogs or wolves. We see them, going into, sharpening sticks with their teeth and jabbing bush babies with them. That's their relationship with other animals or, fishing termites, that kind of thing. But humans are a kind of animal that will actively seek out relationships with other animals. And I think that's other species of animal. And I think that's a very interesting phenomenon, right? Like, even before agriculture, even before plant agriculture, the first domestication was with humans and dogs, right? Like, this and one of the first videos I posted on my channel was about this, right? I like to bring it up often because it's actually a very interesting example. It's the bone. So the site is Bonn Obercastle, which is in Germany, and one of the very first domesticated dogs was found there. It was a puppy, about 8 months old, and it had evidence of a very serious disease called canine distemper. Distemper comes from canine distemper virus, which is a Morbillo virus. And what it does is it basically causes neurological signs, respiratory issues. It causes problems with the development of teeth. And this fossil shows evidence of its enamel was not properly developed. It has really severe periodontal disease, has evidence of arthritis in multiple joints. This was an 8-month-old dog, and it had probably lived with this disease for several weeks to months before it died, at which time it probably was having frequent seizures. It probably wasn't able to feed itself and needed to be cleaned. And so that would have required intensive human care. So this kind of domestication and this dog, it wasn't a useful utilitarian relationship. It was more than that. It was more of a kind of a symbolic or emotional connection that these people have with this animal. And you see quite a lot of these examples, of course, in the human record, in the archaeological record. There's I discussed this in the horse course, but there was a find in Greece from the Iron Age. And it was a horse that had evidence of a leg fracture in one of its metatarsals. Now, you think about a horse breaking its leg, I mean, your thought goes to humane euthanasia is usually indicated, if not surgery, in some cases. Mm-hmm. This horse had a completely shattered, metatarsal, where there's a huge amount of weight on the back leg. But it seems what happened here was that the person who owned this horse was probably well off enough to afford this, a physician to come out and look at his horse and tell him, this horse probably needs to be put down. And they said, no, take care of this horse. They put, the cast of this horse, and it shows evidence of healing. So this horse was able to bear weight on its leg. It wasn't able to do any work throughout the rest of its life, no doubt, because it would have been, lame at a walk. So And it has, there's also evidence of that this horse was also fed fish oil. They're using some fish oil as a supplement, presumably, which is kind of similar to how we treat arthritis today in a lot of our animals. But the point is basically humans form these relationships with animals, and they're not always utilitarian. A lot of the ancient record shows that people were forming relationships with animals that were emotional, like kinship. This is really different than what the other great apes are doing. You look at chimpanzees and bonobos, they're not doing these kind of things, and certainly not the orangutans either. So that's something that really does make us human, ironically enough.
Well, this is interesting. You know, one of the theories I have about this, and this is me on, I'm taking off my scientifically responsible and leftist hat and putting on my crack barely trained in anthropology hat. But it does seem to me that there's a similar relationship there between human kinship extension. So, for example, a female chimpanzee is very unlikely to let anyone else hold that baby. Because while there is adoption behavior in chimpanzees, I don't want to make it sound like they will take care of all great apes will take care of other great apes' kids. But there's a much higher likelihood that a chimp adult just eats that baby for lipids. Now, I'm not saying humans don't occasionally eat other human babies, because there's evidence that we do. But it is very rare for humans to eat people in their own tribal or kinship band, even if the distance is pretty high away. Now, people go, well, of course it's not. But I'm like, well, that just tells you how strong that taboo is. That you do not think about eating. Because babies are helpless little sources of lipids, man. I mean, there's a reason why they probably look delicious. But there's also, we have evolved, and I always put evolved in quotation marks. I believe in evolution, people, but I get a little weary when we start over attributing stuff to direct genetics, to not do that. There are certain biological things that are triggered in humans from pheromones that tamp down on our predation and behavior. But I find it interesting because this also seems to extend somewhat to our relationship to animals. Because I really can't imagine. Yes, chimpanzees have division of labor. Chimpanzees have tool use, but they aren't domesticating shit. Like they're probably going to eat it. Or you know, gorillas, they're probably going to avoid it. That impulse to domesticate other animals and form bonds with them that are not purely utilitarian does seem to be unique to us. And for whatever reason, to me, my suspicion is, and I have no idea how you can prove this, but that it's tied into the same thing that makes us willing to raise other people's kids, just because they're kind of tangentially related to us, that there's something there. You know, whenever I think about human beings, I think, one, we're genocidal monsters, but two, we're also not. This is one of these things where, like, traditional societies, even Christian traditional societies, probably have better views of people than modern people do, because there's all, like, people are all good or people are bad. No, we are totally, like, if we think your kinship, and by that I don't mean, like, we think you're blood related to us, because kinship in humans is not purely about blood relation. I think people really need to understand that, or a lot of human behavior doesn't make sense. But if we think you're kin, and we can figure out kin, we're probably going to be super cool to you, and we're going to try to figure out how you're kin, probably. That's our natural inclination. It's like, okay, like, you're married to so-and-so who's, like, had a dog once, and something, like, that was... knew a dog that I knew, that thus you're like my aunt. So fine. That is a kind of bizarro human reasoning that we have, but it is this kind of symbolic extension of kinship that we try to do. But when we don't do it, we tend to get a little bit extermination-y. And I think that really shows up in our relationship to animals, because if we think an animal's kin, we will be irrational about it. Like, And so the ability, it is clear that our ability to accord symbolic kinship value to things that are clearly not the same as we are is pretty high. And it's also pretty clear the consequences if we don't do that. So, you know, I do think it's just something to think about when we think about how we talk about our relation to animals. Because I've always thought, like, maybe rights isn't the right way to frame it to convince people not to be total jerks to animals. Maybe we do have to talk about relationality to different beings and their, like, relative kinship to us or something. Because, you know, I don't know that rights does the cut at all. Like, it doesn't seem to have that much effect ultimately. Also, you know, there's some counter, like, animals aren't going to respect your rights. So, you know, but they might respect your relationality to them because, I mean, clearly even wild animals will, like, if you are seen as part of their natural flora and fauna, a lot of wild animals will treat you differently than if you're seen as some kind of outside force. I mean, I realize that talking about that is anthropomorphic, but, like, if you've ever dealt with, like, deer populations that are used to you versus deer populations that aren't, there's a very different way in which deers that are used to you are to people who are not a threat to them act versus ones that are used to, you know, dealing with hunters or whatever. And so it's something, I do think it's something we have to think about. We've been talking for about 2 hours, so I'm going to wrap this up. Joy, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find your work?
You can find it in a couple places. So I have my YouTube channel. That's Zoonosis with Joy. And it's pretty cool. I try to upload every couple of weeks or so. I've been sick for a couple of weeks, so it hasn't been updated. But I talk a lot about some of the things that I talk about here. So I talk about humans, animals, talk about diseases, and really what's striking my fancy that week, basically. I also am at the Membry School. I have a course on the archive there, which is available to subscribers. And that one is about horses. So you can learn about the history of horses and how humans have interacted with them. I am doing breeding groups for them as well. So I've got a couple of breeding groups on the go currently. So I think the next one in January will be about, I think it's Wonderful Life by Stephen Jay Gould. So definitely check that one out. And then I will have some upcoming courses with them in 2025. So we'll have to stay tuned for that.
All right, exciting. I won't ask you to spoil what courses that you're going to be offering in 2025, but hopefully people who are interested should check out your discussion with Stephen Jay Gould. I am glad that ultimately Stephen Jay Gould is winning the battle against Richard Dawkins, because for a long time it looked like he wasn't going to. Being dead.
Yeah.
But if I was going to have, like, people read Evolutionary Biologists, I was always like, and you know, it's not because I agree with everything Gould said, but it was always like, please read Gould versus Dawkins. Like, Dawkins is...
We are going to read Dawkins at some point this year too, but, probably a lot less charitably. I haven't read it myself, but I'm withholding judgment until I actually read it, but he strikes me as an old British man, so I don't think it's going to go well.
Well, I won't try to bias you too much, but I have always said that Dawkins is proof that not believing in God doesn't make you not an Anglican prig. It's an interesting scenario. I have read, unfortunately, a lot of Dawkins. I've also read a lot of Gould, there was a little while where Gould had really fell out of favor in the aughts in particular. It seems to have been somewhat reversed. But yeah, you're reading a good book by Gould. I would tell everyone, if you're not even going to go to the reading group, go read some Stephen Jay Gould. He has the distinct advantage that is rare of being an actually accomplished scientist who can write an essay, which, you know, rare if you've read a lot of, yeah, it's a rare combination, sadly. People should check him out. Thank you so much. And I'll put a link to your YouTube channel and to Member School in the show notes so people can find it. Have a great day.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for supporting VarmBlog. If you would like more, you can find our stream on YouTube under my name, C. Derek Varm. You can also find us on Patreon, where you can subscribe for early audio access, additional shows, unexpurged audios, Q&As with me on video, and other perks, such as access to our archives, etc. There are three levels of support. One level even gets you on Patreon shows. Occasionally here you will hear shows done with other creators. I hope you enjoy them. We'd like to thank our producer, Paul Channel Strip, and Bitter Lake and Jason Miles for making our intro and exit music. And thank you for all you do. If you can't support us financially, you can support us by leaving a review on iTunes or your pod catcher of choice. Have a great evening.